Welcome to The Book Show. We're on Twitter at BookshowRTE if you'd like to get in touch. And this evening we hear about Neil Hegarty's debut novel, Inch Levels, which is set in Derry and Donegal, and from illustrator and cartoonist Tom Gauld about his new character, Mooncop. Now, On Immunity and Inoculation is a social critique and history of anti-vaccination trends that started out as a self-critique. Eula Biss initially began researching this topic when she was pregnant with her son, and as she told me, found out more questions than answers.
Actually, it was the questions that made me want to write a book. Initially, my research was just practical. It was just, as a pregnant mother, I wanted to know a little bit more about vaccination. And as soon as I touched the subject, the questions just started proliferating. And I saw not just questions, but fears proliferating too. So I went in with actually very few fears of my own. I had just heard some people say, oh, maybe vaccination isn't very safe. And so I went in with thinking I'll clear this up in an evening of research. And that evening of research turned into 5 years of research.
You explore a lot of intersections in the book, and one of the most interesting is the idea of class and race.
Yes, that was actually a surprise to me, though it shouldn't have been. When I looked into the demographics of who vaccinates and who doesn't, there was a racial and a class component to that. So in the U.S., people who do not vaccinate at all, so who decline all vaccinations, tend to be wealthier, upper middle class women who are married, have a college degree or a higher degree, and make over $75,000 a year. And then there's another kind of vulnerable population of people. So these are people whose children are under-vaccinated. That means that they haven't received all their vaccines. And this population tends to be under-vaccinated not by choice, but by circumstance. So because their parents aren't opposed to vaccination, but they haven't managed to get them all their vaccines. And this population tends to be women who are younger, African-American, poor, below the poverty line. And so it's the relationship between those two groups that was very interesting to me. So these wealthier, well-educated women who aren't vaccinating their children are putting this other group of people at risk. So people who have not made a concerted choice to not to vaccinate, but by circumstance haven't, their children are therefore vulnerable to disease. And if an outbreak starts among children who are unvaccinated, it can move into this other group and vice versa. But what was interesting to me was the possibility that more privileged people were putting less privileged people at risk.
I also learned from your book, which I didn't know, that the term conscientious objector it doesn't come from people who don't want to go to war for you know, reasons of conscience. It's people who don't want to vaccinate their children.
Yes, this was so surprising to me. And it really kind of spun my mind for a moment to learn this. There was this very robust anti-vaccination movement in Victorian England, and that was very much about the relationship between the individual and the state. Yeah, the original usage was people who weren't vaccinating their children used this term to distinguish themselves from people who were just being careless or forgetful or hadn't managed to get to the doctor. So they were using this term, I'm a conscientious objector, to communicate that they, as a matter of conscience, did not want to vaccinate, and that the resistance to vaccination was about a kind of suspicion that the state was claiming too much power over the individual. And actually, you still hear that rhetoric in the United States. So we're removed by, you know, more than 100 years, and we're in a different political situation. But you still hear that kind of tension between individual rights and what the government has claimed as their purview. Laws were made that allowed parents to opt out of vaccination, but they had to prove that it was a matter of conscience, and this became kind of complicated, right? How do you prove that it's your conscience that's at work and not something else? And it's very difficult to parse the difference between what's an act of conscience and what's an act of paranoia or what's an act of resistance. And in some cases in the U.S., people who are resisting vaccination do see themselves and see this act as an anti-capitalist act. So to find all these historical echoes, right, in this very contemporary problem.
There's a fascinating incident in the book where you talk about a woman in Nashville who's selling lollipops infected with chickenpox. And of course, in Ireland, we don't vaccinate against chickenpox. So tell me what vigilante vaccination is.
Yes, so this was a term that was used around this case of a woman selling lollipops that were intended to give chickenpox to children, because it comes out of this, you know, kind of interesting paradox that so many people are vaccinated now in the United States that if you don't vaccinate your child against chickenpox, it's actually kind of difficult to get it. But parents who don't vaccinate their children against chickenpox know that it's important that those children get infected before adulthood, because in your late teens and 20s, chickenpox can be very dangerous. So they're in a tricky situation if they decline vaccination. This woman got kind of described as practicing vigilante vaccination. So it's kind of outside the regular practices, outside the laws, in that she was breaking the law in that you're not allowed in the U.S. to send live viruses through the mail, and that's what she was trying to do. Though when I spoke to immunologists and doctors about this, there was quite a bit of suspicion that she would not actually have been able to transmit chickenpox this way. The virus is too fragile to travel on a lollipop through the mail. But there are viruses that are hardy enough to travel that way, and so Hep B is one of them. And Hep B can have very serious consequences, including cancer of the liver. And so it's possible that this vigilante practitioner could have failed to produce chickenpox in a child, but succeeded to produce Hep B.
You've immersed yourself in the history of vaccination and anti-vaccination, and it's been quite a global thing. You haven't just focused on the US. So you've been really in it. So has writing this book changed the way you and your family interact with the medical profession? Do you go to the doctor more or less?
You know, that's a really interesting question. It in some ways, working on this book has validated some practices that were already in place for me. So I was raised by a physician. My father's a doctor, but I was raised to be quite wary of medical care. So actually, I was raised with a strong belief in preventative medicine, and the sense that you should always participate in preventative medicine, but that otherwise you ought to avoid the doctor when necessary. And that was my upbringing, and it's still my practice. Though I'm always having to adjust and readjust that practice. But I also am still always wrestling with this question of how much medical care is enough and how much is too little. And I did have a moment, a kind of sobering moment for me, when my son was about 5. He had a sore throat and a fever. And by this time, we'd seen many sore throats and many fevers. And I made the call that we would not take him into the doctor, that I felt that this would pass. I'd seen many sore throats pass. I'd seen many fevers pass. And I still think that that was a reasonable call to make. I still think that it's reasonable to resist over-medicalizing childhood and pregnancy and other situations that are medicalized quite a bit. But in this case, he had strep throat. We didn't know it. The strep throat progressed, and he woke up with a head-to-toe bright red rash. He had scarlet fever, and it was the sickest I have ever seen him. And it was, for me, kind of particularly scary because my father's brother, my uncle, had scarlet fever as a child and developed rheumatic fever, which was common at that time because there weren't, where he lived, there wasn't good access to antibiotics. And his brother, my uncle, sustained heart damage that eventually killed him. And so my son was fine. He was treated with antibiotics. He got over scarlet fever, but It was scary for me to have that kind of near brush with something that I knew had done so much damage to someone in my family. And my father's pain over his brother's death has remained fresh, actually. And for me, it was a very emotional experience. And it was a reminder that we need medicine. We really do. And if I hadn't had access to those antibiotics, my son was very, very ill, and I hate to think about what would have happened if I hadn't had access to that medicine. I guess it's a question that just remains complicated to me. This is a long period of learning for a new parent, and you know, it's now nearly a decade. So I think to some extent it still makes sense to me to err on the side of caution.
And Eulabissa's On Immunity is published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. Now, Inch Levels by Neil Hegarty explores a family and their secrets over two generations. It's set in Derry and Donegal against a backdrop of World War II and the Troubles. Neil Hegarty told us about the book.
We meet Patrick, the main character in Inch Levels, on his deathbed. He's in the final days and weeks of his life in a hospital in Derry. He's reassessing, or he's trying to reassess, the course of his life, what he did right, what he did wrong, what he said and what he didn't say. The nurse, busy with a chart, with a pen, looked up to the head of the bed. "All right there, sweetheart." Patrick nodded his head, a very little. "A dream. I was dreaming. A nice dream, I hope." He flinched at her hearty tone. "Remembering when I was a boy," he said, "with my sister. A trip to the beach we made." And it's those gaps between what he said and what he didn't say that I was interested in as I constructed his character, and indeed the other characters in the book as well. They're very much engaged in the process of living their life with the lid on. The nurse nodded knowledgeably. This was standard, she knew from her training. The patients tended to go back as the end drew near, to evaluate and shuffle memories, reassessing, considering. This is a generational story, so there are two generations of one family growing up in Derry and in Donegal, just on either side of the border. The older generation is exemplified really by the character of Sarah, who's the matriarch. The younger generation is exemplified by the characters of Patrick and his sister Margaret, who's a few years older. There is tension between them, there's rivalry between them, but for the most part there's great love, there's great loyalty. And it's the love and the loyalty which really gets them into trouble. I was interested in exploring a story which spoke of the consequences of love. What happens when you love somebody? What happens when you love them too much, or not enough, or in the wrong way? Sarah was sitting on the sand with her face turned up to the sun. He was first into the water. He beat Margaret to it. She was speechless with rage. Older, 2 years older, but second this time, speechless. Goaded beyond bearing. She might have drowned her little brother that day. Instead, she realised how much she loved him. He saw it all now, with the benefit of hindsight. Inch Levels, it's an actual place. It's a landscape on the shores of Lough Swilly, just a few miles west of Derry. So it's an actual place. This book opens on Inch Levels, where something terrible happens. A child has gone missing, and her body is discovered there in this very lovely place. The colour photograph of the girl that had been circulated to the media was of good quality. Patrick remembered the photograph, remembered how Christine was smiling, a beaming smile. But this, in the long run, made little difference. The family was articulate, but this made little difference too. The case was remembered, talked of. But there were so many others, so many other crimes, so many other examples of depraved human behaviour, of sin and of grief, that this crime became but one on a list. He remembered all this. I wanted to talk about what happens when you keep a secret in a family. So there are many secrets threading the lives of this family, but there's a secret hidden at the very heart of the story, which becomes clear at the end, and which if you like, it booby traps everybody's life, everybody's lives, the lives of all the people in this family, and it distorts their relationships with each other and with the world. Plenty of people, Sarah said, saw worse things than I did. They don't talk much about it, but they still carry it all around in their heads. She looked back along the shingle. There were her children now, moving into view along the edge of the water. All this concentration on the past and the present, she thought, is what I mean. Yet she was concentrating on present and past, flooding her life with the past, the seawall crumbling. She could smell the danger of it, and yet there was nothing she could do. She was set fast in her course. One of the things I was interested in was in exploring how we remember our lives, how we remember history. So we look back at our lives and we don't remember it as a unchanging course, like a current, like a river. We remember bits here and bits there, scraps here and scraps there. And I wrote the book in the same way. If you think about Chinese whispers, flooding her life with the past, the seawall crumbling. She could smell the danger of it, for them all and for her children. One story is told in a certain form, then it's told again and it's told again, and we come to the truth of the matter in the end. Concentrating on present and past, flooding her life with the past, the seawall crumbling. What I wanted was for the reader to come to the end of the story, having shifted back and forth in time and space and from voice to voice, and finally, at the end, you see the full picture. You see the whole portrait of these people's lives.
Inch Levels by Neil Hegarty is published by Head of Zeus. Now, Tom Gauld is well known for his cartoons in the Guardian newspaper, and his new graphic novel follows a lunar colony which is slowly in decline. Its main character, Mooncop, polices the settlement.
Mooncop's a story set in a fictional future where humanity has colonised the moon, and the main character is a policeman on that colony. But there not being a great deal to do on the moon, most people have moved back, and Mooncop doesn't have a lot of crime to deal with and spends quite a lot of time driving around in his little car and eating coffee and donuts. And the story is him trying to deal with his moon dream kind of collapsing.
Obviously, Tom, you've drawn a lot of space imagery before, and a standalone work, and also in your previous book, You're All Just Jealous of My Jetpack. So why did you return to the moon for a Mooncop?
I've been wanting to write a science fiction graphic novel for a while. In fact, more or less since I started drawing comics. And I've always wanted to do more comics about the moon. Some of my earliest comics were about two bickering astronauts on the moon, and I really like doing those. I like the atmosphere of the moon, that kind of quiet coldness and the loneliness that people, even when there's more than one of them, get when they're up there. So I've been intending to work on something for a while, and it was just finding a story which would fit into that atmosphere and be interesting in that place.
As I was reading it, I was thinking of, you know, that great tagline from Alien, in space, no one can hear you scream. And it seems that the story is in many ways one of loneliness. So is the moon, I suppose, is the ultimate setting for something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's the main character is definitely a bit lost, and he's a little bit depressed. And I think the tranquility and quietness of the moon echoes that. He's not crippled with a terrible depression, and he still understands some of the beauty of being up there, and he sits in his car and looks at the Earth floating by. And I guess I want a mixture of that kind of majesty, but also with the atmosphere. I keep saying atmosphere, even though the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, but I guess that's part of it too.
But also, as you say, you're looking at isolation and, you know, themes of humans being replaced by technology and the mundanity of everyday life, whether you're on Earth or the moon. But you also make it very funny. So how do you take these things that can be quite, you know, morose and make them funny?
I think that's just the natural thing for me to do. I think generally things that are funny are not good, not happy things. Happiness is not terribly funny. whereas things going wrong, things failing, those are things which are easier to make funny and things that I find easier to make funny. I want all my comics to have an atmosphere of funniness, but also some sadness in there. And I'm not sure why those two things appeal to me, but as two ingredients, I find them very attractive.
In the book, technology is sort of shown as taking over and sort of replacing humans and of depersonalizing things. What's your own view of modern technology? Good, bad, evil?
Well, it's kind of mixed, and I suppose the story of Mooncop is a bit mixed, because I think that mission of the Apollo astronauts going to the moon is one of the most incredible, impressive things humanity's ever done. And I think it's wonderful, that technology. And in the story, the main character feels that as well. And the thing which is getting him down, and I suppose the thing which gets most people down, is it's not technology when it's that. It's the technology which becomes a problem or makes you as a human have to behave like a robot, and the technology that's supposed to make things better but doesn't. So I'm a big fan of technology, but I think quite often it doesn't help anyone.
I thought there was a little kind of bit of subversion in that everything is automated and everything has been replaced and updated and modernised. And yet when Mooncop goes home, he has a doorman, which seems really kind of antiquated almost. And was that your way of sort of, you know, being a little bit nodding to quaint old fashionedness and subverting the fact that, you know, technology can't take over everything?
Yeah, I suppose it is. That's true. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about when I was making the story was not just about the space race, but also about the feeling from the 60s and even into the 70s a little that technology was a good thing. And the architecture from them was very utopian, and people were trying to find a better way to live. And a lot of the architecture in my comic is based around that. And that, I think there was a feeling then that modernism was great, but it didn't have to be soulless. And the doorman there, I guess, is like that. You know, it's a fancy big building, but it still has a bit of a human face at the beginning of the story anyway.
In terms of how the colour we see on the page, the palette is very muted. We've got these sort of blues and greys and navies, and that's pretty much all we've got. So is it easier to be very concise with the colour, or is it harder? And I think the blue reinforces the sadness of things as well.
It does, and I think, but also it's quite hard to work with colours in a comic, and I find colour is one of the more difficult aspects. And when you get it right, it can be wonderful and subtly add to everything else. But for a whole book, having to work out the colour on every page, I just thought I wouldn't be able to make it all different. And I found it easier to pick a plan and stick to it, a very simple plan, and then work within that. And with all my work, I do set myself rules and stick to very simple things and then try and work within them.
A lot of people will know your work from The Guardian, and you illustrate a lot of book-themed cartoons, often making fun of genres and of cliché and of being a reader. Do you think there's an elitism in reading, and should people get over that?
I think there is probably less of that than there used to be, but I think there is a little bit. And for The Guardian, who I do a cartoon for most weeks, they give me the theme about what I should do the cartoon about. And about four times I've done it either about science fiction authors being annoyed at not being taken seriously, or literary people being snooty about science fiction. And that's definitely, I think it's probably less than it was, but I think that's definitely still a thing. But for that reason, it's fun for me to make fun of it. And having done it four times, I've tried to, if I can, I'd try and make fun of everybody involved in some way or other.
You've obviously become very successful in your field, but is it a tough industry to make it in? And what would you say to anybody who would be listening to this show who's interested in a career in illustration or drawing cartoons?
I think it is probably quite a difficult career to make a living in and to make a name for yourself. But I don't think I really thought that when I started. I think you have to I wouldn't want to put anyone off for that reason. I think being a bit naive and just going for it is probably the best way to do it. And I think I have been surprised over my career how much people seemed to be happy for me to do my own thing and to be myself. I think I thought as an illustrator I'd be doing a lot more of what other people told me to. But actually, I think if you do your own thing and do it well and work very hard at it, then there is the opportunity to do your own things and say your own things.
Tom Gold there, and Mooncop is published by Drawn and Quarterly. That's it for this week. Thanks to producer Regan Hutchins and series producer Zoe Cummins.